Okay, the Planning Commission's work session is now in session. First order of business is roll call. Mr. Commissioner Thailand.
Mr. Escobar is here.
Okay, Mr. Escobar.
Live and not by Zoom.
Yeah, I'm here too.
Bob's here, Gary.
Commissioner Berman is here.
Commissioner Berman is here.
Commissioner East is here.
And Commissioner.
And I'm here too.
And Commissioner Blom?
I'm here too, by Zoom.
Great.
I'm heading home tomorrow.
But we can't see you.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
That's a good thing. Don't say that.
And Commissioner, is he? We don't know.
I haven't heard from Commissioner Hanselman.
He's trapped on Wade Way. Okay.
Unexcused absence.
Oh, an unexcused absence. Okay. That means he's limited to no more than 3 minutes of his rants. Okay, first order of business here is Mr. Tokos going to discuss. I assume he's going to discuss.
There we go. Yeah, I was going to touch on the legislative update, just kind of work through the work session agenda, if that's good for you.
Let it be known that Commissioner Hanselman has graced us.
Oh, they come.
Thank you.
Jim? How are you?
So this is the first item in the work session is a legislative summary. I do this every time the legislative session wraps up to at least share with you in a combined way kind of what all of the bills were and kind of the direction they went, but it also helps inform changes that we need to make so we're current in terms of what's on the books in the city's municipal code, so that we don't make mistakes moving forward. This session, the 2023 session, actually didn't have as many bills passed as some other sessions. I suspect that's because they had an extended break there for a period of time where they couldn't do any business. And so we also continue to see the trend of mega bills where they put a lot of different elements into an individual bill that you have to kind of sort through and figure out, how all it, what all it impacts. Again, heavy emphasis on housing has been the last few sessions. Same with wildfire preparedness, climate change, resiliency, those types of topics. The first bills I noted were the 60-day housing package that happened early in the session, effective March 29th. That was House Bill 2001 and House Bill 5019. The big piece there really was funding for a variety of state agencies and organizations that provide services to those that are houseless. Most of that went to the larger areas, Portland's, the Salem's, the Eugene's of the world. There is funding in there that will help pay for the Oregon Housing Needs Analysis, or they call it the ONA. You may recall we finished a housing capacity analysis to comply with state, what was it, House Bill's 2001, 2019 flavor, House Bill 2003. We just wrapped up that work. We're one of the first, actually, of the communities to wrap up that work. And now we'll need to figure out whether or not some of that housing capacity and work that we did is going to get superseded by this Oregon Housing Needs Assessment, whether or not they set a bar in terms of the number of units they expect a city like Newport to be able to produce, whether that bar is going to be different than what we set in our capacity analysis. So we'll see. We'll see how that process plays out.
You're suggesting much of that money is going to larger population centers?
The funding for services to those that are houseless, yes. Much of that went to larger areas. that have nonprofits with maybe a little bit more capacity than we have, established services where they could get the funds out quickly. You may recall we're still working through the House Bill 4123, where the county's taken a lead, but you know, we have a seat at the table along with all the other cities. And part of what House Bill 4123 from the prior session was about was building rural capacity so that we have an organizational structure and we have nonprofits that can effectively take that state money and really put it to use and, you know, build up their staffing and things of that nature. And so we'll see how 4123 plays out. I mean, that's well on its way. The consultants on that are starting to go from the high level where everybody can agree to the specific where there's starting to be disagreements. And so they got to work through that.
You're participating in that?
The city of Newport is. Yes, I am. Spencer's the lead, is our city manager, and we have two elected officials on there. We have Councilor Jacoby and Kaplan. Both have been participating.
So it's our city manager, mm-hmm. Commissioner Kaplan?
Yes.
And Jacoby. Is there a third person representing the city?
Jacoby. Okay. Councilor Jacoby. So we have two electeds on the policy committee. And then Spencer sits on that as well. And then I work on one of the subcommittees that's on the service end. So we've got a number of people plugged in at different levels.
I guess they changed the 10,000 to 12,000 and get us out of a whole bunch of stuff.
That would be nice.
I'm going to move on to the next bill, commercial conversions, House Bill 2984. This is one that we're probably going to need to adopt something before the end of the year that makes it clear that when you do a commercial conversion to residential, our system development charge methodology applies. It has always applied. Now, we give credit for pre-existing use, so you don't pay full bill when you do a conversion. But sometimes there is something that you do end up needing to pay, depending on is the conversion just simply the conversion of an existing building within the existing footprint, or is there an addition to the building as part of the conversion. I mean, they come in different flavors. So, but that's something we'll need to do. And then we're probably gonna need to take a look at some of the NIBEJ rules. That's the next bill, House Bill 3395. I don't know how much longer we can hold to the prohibition of residential use on street grade, because these bills continue to say, hey, look, we want for affordable housing at least to be able to locate in commercial areas. And so we'll need to take a look under 3395, how much additional flexibility we have there. Right now, as you know, in NIBEJ, the commercial core area, you can't do residential at street grade unless it was already there as of like 2004. When you get further out, you can do residential. It's a full flex, residential commercial. But the core area there, when you think of it like Beach Drive and Coast and Third, that area, you can't do residential at street grade in the commercial unless it was pre-existing. So we'll have to take a look at that. 3395 also. We'll need to add, we're going to need to make some changes to our subdivision guarantees. If affordable in our improvement agreement language in our code, right now we have a language like many jurisdictions where if somebody's doing a significant development project that has frontage improvements, for example, and they can't get all of them done, they can do an improvement agreement to get occupancy, and then they guarantee that they'll get the work done within a 12-month period. And we're limited in terms of right now what we accept as financial guarantees. This legislation requires that if it's an affordable housing project, the financial guarantee can be from, say, Oregon Housing and Community Services, but it's not in the form of, like your traditional lending guarantees, like a letter of credit or something of that nature. What else do we have in here?
That isn't a substantive change, then. It's just a...
It's an additional financial guarantee that we will need to accept. That's what it is. So we just want to make sure it gets reflected there. We currently list three or four different things that are sufficient for guaranteeing improvements. This will be one more.
Now, is this like over and above any bonds that they're required to post?
It'd be an alternative to a performance bond. So a surety bond or performance bond is one of the financial mechanisms. But a lot of these affordable housing folks are like, well, we don't want to go to the expense of paying a surety company to do a performance bond on this. We just want to provide you a letter from Oregon Housing Community Service saying that they'll make sure it's covered. What else got in that? This was one of those with a number of different pieces in it. Section 6 and 7 address the siding. For homeless shelters, we've had a number of legislative sessions now where they've made it clear that they want them, it's called the super siding provisions, where they want them out of the land use context. You can hold a hearing, that's fine, but not a land use hearing that's appealable to the Land Use Board of Appeals and can be tied up in litigation for eons. So what they do is they keep doing these super siding bills and they keep pushing out for a couple years. So each legislative session is like, we'll extend the period within which you can super side a shelter two more years. And so one of the things we'll probably want to talk about is how do we want to handle shelter siding? Do we want to just pull it out of the land use and make it a public hearing with the council? We'll have a chance to talk about it and see how we want to tackle it. And then they stuck in single-room occupancy rules, yeah, which we don't actually have in our code, SROs. And, John, you're probably familiar with it. San Francisco deals with single-room occupancies quite a bit.
Yes.
So what they actually did, though, is they provide a definition for what a single-room occupancy is, and then we're going to be required to allow them at a density of 6 units on any lot where a single-family detached dwelling is allowed. So that means R1 and R2, all of it.
Talking about boarding houses?
Basically, think about 6 rooms occupied by 6 different households or individuals, all of which share a common, kitchen, so forth. Yep.
And these are expected to be privately owned, not rentals?
I don't know that the legislation gets into that kind of aspect of it.
Okay, just that they could exist in this.
Yeah. That's we're going to have to change our rules to allow it.
Okay.
What form they take, I don't know right now.
No, I just...
There's a small apartment dwelling house just to the north of the Bierstein.
Okay.
It's kind of L-shaped and it's gray. Did that used to be a motel?
Bierstein?
It looked as though the units are pretty small. Right over here on the back street, what is it, 9th?
You mean by Beer One?
By Beer One, right.
Oh, okay.
Does anybody know which building I'm talking of?
Not off the dice.
North or sure.
Just it be immediately north of the Beer One. And it's almost a little L-shaped.
Yeah.
It just seemed that they're pretty tiny units.
Yeah, kind of like tiny cottages, kind of. Mm-hmm.
As is often the case with legislation, they didn't cleanly sync it up with the building code. Building code limits under the residential code 5 rooms. The SRO would basically allow 6 bedrooms. So that'll push it into a different occupancy and some different, we're going to have to sort through some of that on our end, how we deal with that.
Does this apply?
It can trigger sprinklering of a building, things of that nature too.
Does this apply to ADUs also?
ADUs are a different type, so no, it's separate from that. ADUs, we already allow on every lot where there's a single family dwelling.
Right. But if somebody wants to convert the ADU because it's a big ADU into 6 separate bedrooms.
This would allow it as
an SRO. Would allow that.
Remember, this isn't authorizing short-term rentals. So we have our own separate code for that. So we're not talking about short-term rentals at all.
Right.
SROs here would be a month-to-month rental arrangement. I don't know how much the way of this type of development we're going to actually see. So I wouldn't get too alarmed about it. It's more common in more densely developed areas. But It's something we're going to need to accommodate in the code.
I noticed that Lincoln City is starting to take some of their hotels. They've had groups come in to buy hotels and convert those into affordable housing or...
Transitional housing.
Transitional housing.
Yep, yep. Project Turnkey. What is it? Sheila Stiley with the Northwest Coastal Housing's done project up there. And it's close. It's close, except they don't really have kitchens. As she explained to me, what they do is, I mean, they basically cook with microwaves. They don't really have full functioning kitchens. Where I would expect this kind of SRO would have a full functioning
dining area, separate from the
unit.
Individual units.
Correct.
This would be, if it's affordable, it would be have the availability of using all the various incentive programs.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. Yeah, like the, if they'd have, I mean, remember the multiple use property tax exemption, which is one of those incentive programs, they'd have to show the project wouldn't pencil out if not for the break. But it, that's an option.
But these aren't designated that they have to be affordable.
Nope. No, they can be market.
Right, right, yeah. Market rate.
Photo radar, House Bill 2095. We get to do this now, and our police chief is looking into, you know, this, and we'll be briefing council on, you know, what the bill allows and whether or not, you know, the city should be looking into doing any of the photo radar. So that'll be a briefing in the coming weeks, I believe. They've got that on a work program.
So who is the local speed setting authority? Is that Malloy?
Currently, the designated speed limit on streets is set by ODOT through a methodology. And it's a, you know, it's a very specific methodology. It's a speed study. They see how many, you know, they actually put down counters to see, you know, how much traffic's going through a particular area, what speeds, yada, yada, yada. And then they figure out, okay, then based on the classification of the street and the conditions in the area, it fits in this kind of window in terms of what its speed should be. And so they spit out of that. You know, Ocean View is a good example. They just finished a speed study again on Ocean View, and again came out at 35 miles an hour. It's what the state says is the appropriate speed limit. On the north segment, 25, on the south segment, where it's all windy and hard to, you know, you couldn't drive 35 safely anyway.
Well, on the north segment of 101 from the RV resort north, I mean, it's like the Autobahn. I mean, people are zipping there 65 and 70. And, you know, so would this allow us to drop that speed limit from 55 to 45?
There's, yeah, the change in here, there's a provision in the law that says that cities can, by ordinance,
right,
establish a designated speed for a roadway that is up to 10 miles per hour lower than the statutory speed. And I want to be careful here because designated speed and statutory speed are different things. They're defined differently in state law. So, yes, there's some play in certain circumstances for us to drop speeds by up to 10 miles per hour.
But
we'd have to look into under what circumstances specifically we can do that.
But isn't Highway 101 not under our jurisdiction?
Well, sorry, yeah. US 101 and US 20 are under ODOT's jurisdiction. We can't drop speeds there. We can only ask them if they would do it. But everything else is fair game.
Okay, I guess I'll write to the Congress.
There you go.
I'm getting no satisfaction out of ODOT.
They could drop it.
Drop it to 45.
Drop it to 45 a little bit more north, just a little farther.
Well, I mean, 73rd Street, I mean, a block north of 73rd is the city limit. So you could drop it, put 45 there. I mean, you know, I'm kind of the unofficial mayor of 71st Street, 72nd Street.
But we've got a, I don't know if it'll extend quite that far north, but you know, we are working on a new ped crossing at 60th, And as
what?
The enhanced ped crossing at 60th at Surfview Village.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one's going to have a pretty extended length because you're dealing with higher speeds through there. So we may have an opportunity to talk to them about, you know, their overall speeds and what could be done. But, you know, as you just noted, you know, a minute ago, posted speed and driver behavior are two different things. I mean, if it's conducive to higher speeds, people drive higher speeds. Even if it's posted, it'll, you know, there's only so much you can do. That's my point.
Well, I know, but I mean, a lot of people up on the 71st, 72nd tried to go to the beach, mm-hmm. and they go down to Avery and 101 to cross there, and I'm telling you, the traffic through there is, you know, I mean, it's way above 55. I mean, if we photo enhanced it, we could make up whatever budget shortfalls the city has, particularly in the summertime. I cross there not every day, but frequently, and I'm telling you, I mean, I'm starting to wear my yellow safety vest so people can see me because I've almost been hit twice.
What would it take to get at least a marked crosswalk there?
Up at 71st?
No, Avery and 101 up there.
I'm going to take a look and see how we address it in the TSP. If it's in the TSP, then you have a chance. If it's not in the TSP, I think it's a harder thing to pull off. And I mean, ODOT's going to want to see a bunch of data as to you know why it's justified.
Well, I'm sure that when they dropped the speed limit to 45 at the RV resort, there was, you know, those neighborhoods weren't even developed way back then. And now that those neighborhoods are developed, it's, you know.
Planning.
Derek, you just mentioned TSP. Something occurred to me. Did we, when we did the TSP, and I don't recall, did we include those areas that are going to be annexed sometime in the next couple of years for analysis as for projects?
Yeah, we looked at everything within the urban growth boundary.
Okay, good.
That was the outlier, you know, for us. So everything inside the UGB was looked at. House Bill 3167, notice in digital newspapers. We probably want to capture that in our code, given the direction our local paper's been going. It basically says if you don't have a local paper, you can notice digitally. If you do have a local paper that has a certain circulation, you need to go that route. So what's it? It's an outlet because, you know, as we've talked about in the past, there are a number of areas, including more populated areas, that are seeing their traditional print media go away. And you have a large number of these legal publication requirements, and you need a way to accommodate them. And you can debate whether or not maybe the state should be rethinking legal publications because they were developed at a different time when people looked at print media in a different way. And so maybe they ought to be looking at this more holistically, but this is a start. It's a small start. House Bill 2898, post-disaster temporary housing. We have a clause under our temporary use code that had implemented the previous version that gives folks 24 months to live in an RV while they rebuild after, say, they lose their house to a fire. State changed that, extended it to 5 years. So we're going to need to change that language to 5 years. I think they're just struggling. You know, they still have a lot of people that are displaced from those wildfires a couple of years ago. And the recovery is going so slow that they recognize they needed to provide some additional time. House Bill 33113, ODOT Great Streets Program. I just pointed that out. Once we make a final decision on what the solution is in the city center area, that's one of the funding pots we can go after to get state money to match with local urban renewal funds to get the project done. And it's encouraging that they're continuing to funnel money into the program, even though it's not dramatically large money. So that'd be something to look at moving forward. House Bill 3458, again, nothing we need to do in our code. it limits appellate's ability to raise new issues on remand. So when I say remand, and this is common, you know, in the land use context, you have, say, controversial land use decision. It gets appealed up to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Land Use Board of Appeals finds, say, in favor of one of 6 or 8 points that the appellant made, remands it back down to the local government to clean up the decision relative to that one point. What this is saying, original appellant, you can't throw a bunch of new stuff in now. This is not fair game to go after it again. So that's really what it is. You know, so it's trying to stop a legal strategy, which is to keep things in court, you know. And then 3409 is the climate package. This is something I actually passed along to Spencer, because one of the provisions in this one, the city's going to need to start getting ready for, has to do with performance standards for commercial buildings. And we're going to need to deal with it, not so much here in the Planning Commission, but on our building code side. This is something that'll come in and we're going to need to deal with. It's for larger buildings, and so you're talking 35,000 square feet, rec center, not city hall. I mean, so you're talking about a very big building, but, you know, there are some pretty good-sized buildings like Rogues, you know, the Rogues Brewery in South Beach. That's going to be over the top. I suspect at least one of PAC Seafood's processors is going to be over that when you consider their component parts. So there'll be a few of these in the city. You know, the legislature created a Tier 1, which is going to, by, what is it, 2025, they're going to say what that energy performance standard is going to need to be, and we're going to have to start upgrading these buildings by 2028. So that'll be a cost to the city for the rec center. We don't know what the energy performance standards are yet. That's going to be handled by Department of Energy, and they're going to be coordinating with the Building Codes Division at the state level. But so in July of 25, we're going to find out what those standards are, which is going to inform how we need to retrofit. And then 2028 for the Tier 1s, that's when compliance kicks in.
Provision for funding to help retrofit some of the older buildings?
Not yet. There could very well be before it's all said and done. But that was one of the concerns the League of Oregon Cities had, which was another unfunded mandate from the state. Where's the money come from to retrofit these buildings?
Schools
now, the state
also fall under that.
They did a carve-out for schools and hospitals. They made them a Tier 2. So they have, which basically, from the best I can tell from the bill, means they just have more time.
You know the distinction between Tier 1 and Tier 2?
In part, it had to do whether or not it was a hospital, school, university, or dormitory, or if it's just a general commercial building, it's from 20,000 square feet to 35,000 square feet. So City Hall might actually get hooked on the Tier 2. I have to go back and look at the calculations. They're pretty close.
Kinds of things are they going to put in the standards, do you think?
Well, energy performance. Requiring
solar on the roof? Or...
Well, they could.
Well, won't they most likely just pick a national standard, like a LEED accreditation level? I mean, that's what we did in San Francisco and in California. LEED goal, LEED plan.
Retrofit.
Just pick a level, and then that.
It's always, yeah, it's always
that addresses
a little,
all the building functions.
It would make sense for them to go off of an existing, you know, performance metric that's already out there, and there are several. LEED's one. There were a couple others that we've dealt with before. But they'll need to be keyed towards retrofit, because this is all about retrofitting existing buildings. And so some things you do with a new build, I mean, just aren't practical,
right?
You know, for an existing building. But I mean, it could get into all kinds of stuff. Solar's one, but I would think more like, you know, we could be in a position where we have to swap out all our windows, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, or we have to somehow improve the insulation in the building. I mean, there are different things.
Are they incorporating the same things in the building code then for new building? new development?
There are new performance standards on the building code side too. I don't know how well the two sync. We don't know yet because they're not going to roll out the performance standards on this until July of 25. But for purposes of a municipal budget, it's something we need to watch because it's going to be a cost.
Last line of your synopsis suggests that there might be a grant program.
Community Green Infrastructure Grant Program. That's really keyed more to urban tree canopies and that kind of thing. But like I said, there's before they're talking about implementation in 2028. And if there's no funding that goes, there's probably going to be some funding. The question is it enough? I'm sure they'll do something. They're not going to do nothing. But it's undoubtedly what usually happens with Salem is it's a percentage of what you really need.
Your notes suggest that this House bill didn't pass.
3414 did not pass.
3409. Oh, 3414 didn't pass.
Correct.
But 3409 did pass.
Yes. 3414 is, we've been, I understand through the league that the governor's office is teeing that up for another run during the short session. So that's likely to come up here pretty quick. Some form of it. Remember, that's the one that basically said a developer would be able to get up to 10 adjustments to things they don't want to do in a local code. And then it had a set of, except those adjustments couldn't apply to certain circumstances. But if it was, you know, outside of those circumstances, they could just basically say, we don't want to do it. So, and then it also had the Housing Accountability Office piece, which was a new office at the state level to work through disputes as part of the local permitting process. So those two pieces are likely to come back in the short session. So as I've done in the past, my plan here is it's not an earth-shattering number of changes to the code. It's to kind of work that into a single code update to implement the legislative package. Excuse me. And I think I have some dates for that on the work program. So that's all I had for that.
So a question, Derek, about implementing the changes to local code. So I'm assuming these are public hearings that would be held with lots of text revisions to conform.
Yeah, as few text revisions as possible.
But is there really an option to say, no, we don't want to do that? I mean, isn't it state law mandating a local authority make the changes, right? In some cases.
Yeah, and each legislative session is different. Sometimes we have a little bit of flexibility in how we handle it. Sometimes we have a lot of flexibility. That doesn't happen as often as it used to. And then sometimes we have none. But even when we don't have flexibility, it's important to get it in the municipal code because we always run the risk then of having a code and a statute that are in conflict. And then the issue comes up at a local level. We rely on our code. We don't work off of code and statutes at the same time. So it's important that our code comport to current state law.
I'm just thinking it may be good to be able to depict those areas where we don't have much flexibility or it's very simplistic change.
Right.
So that the public understands.
Right.
This is a state mandate here. Here we have flexibility. Your comment has import. Here we don't. Sorry, the may becomes a shall or whatever.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. No, that's fair. We need to be very clear about that when we go through these processes. Yeah. This one is a mandate. This one we have flexibility because we deal with both.
Okay. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, next is the parking management strategy rollout.
We are moving along here. I'm just bringing up the FAQ that you have in your packet. I trust you had a chance to take a look at it. It's version 2. The first version I'd worked through with the Parking Advisory Committee and made some changes to the FAQ based on that feedback. And There'll be a separate, and the front of it has just the frequent FAQ questions and answers, and in the back of it has a map showing the permit program that's planned down on the bayfront. And I also included in your packet an implementation schedule. At this point in time, we are looking at well, we got a couple different things in play. We've got parking lot refurbishment on the bay front, which includes three lots, what we call the Abbey Street lot, which is the big one that's between Rogue Brewery Restaurant and the market. Then we have the Bay Boulevard lot, which is the only one on the bay side of Bay Boulevard, and that's one next to Pacific Seafood. And then we have the Hatfield lot, which is this little one. It's not marked here, but it's this little one right here, which is the one next to Coffee House and the Hatfield pump station. It's a gravel lot. It's going to be surfaced, and there'll be four parking spaces, one of which is an ADA accessible space. With the Bay Boulevard lot, we'll be adding in an additional accessible space. And then the Abbey Street lot already has, I think, a healthy number of accessible spaces, particularly in and around the restroom there. But that's going to be, you know, I mean, we're fully refurbishing each of the lots. I think the Bay Boulevard one is a grind and inlay, so we'll be doing quite a bit of work on that smaller lot there. So that work is going to start. Council just awarded the contract on that. That work's going to start probably mid to late September, so we're just going to need to reach out to folks just to let them know parking lots are going to be worked on and what the plan is of attack. The expectation is the contractor is not going to take more than one lot out of commission at any point in time. So they'll do work on one shift, then do work on another. But we're going to have to be proactive on that to make sure people aren't in the lots and we can get the vehicles out of there so that they can get the work done. And so that's one piece. And then we actually have the implementation of the demand management, the metering program that we're going to be doing down there, meter permit, time to permit. And that we're looking to get that to go online in mid-October. And we're looking at doing most of our outreach in September at this point. And I believe we have September 6th, we'll be meeting with the Commercial Fishing Users Group. I'll put together a slightly different version of this for them because there's some rules that'll be a little bit different for them that they're going to want to talk about. Port Commission later in September, I'll be working with Janelle Goplin, who's on our Parking Advisory Committee, and she'll help coordinate the business owner meeting down on the bayfront. And then I'll be reaching out to the managers at PAX Seafood and Bornstein's to have a meeting with their staffs, or at least make ourselves available to kind of go through what the program will be. By that time, we should have the e-permitting structure up, and I'll be able to talk in a little bit more detail about the e-permit options. We're still in the process of working through with our parking vendor, T2, on getting that whole structure put in place. So that's where we're at right now. And the council has the council be looking at the, we got the bids in on the sign install and the work on the foundations for the pay stations, which was the last major piece, and it came in just a little bit under our engineer's estimate, which is good. And so that's going to council at their upcoming meeting. And so that, what we chose to do because we didn't want to overwhelm our public works staff, they have staffing limitations of their own, is we took basically half of the signage that needs to be done down there, pole swap outs, things of that nature. Contractors are going to do the half that's in the developed area, the more complex ones, where they're doing work where we have existing paved areas, sidewalks, things of that nature. And then our public works crews will install the other half, the sign package and poles, and those poles would be in the areas that are undeveloped right now. So just a little simpler install for them. It doesn't take them away from all the other streets work that they need to do. When it's all said and done, it looks like we're pretty close to the original budgeted amount, which was $640,000 for the project. Of that, there's a $225,000 interfund loan that we'll be doing either off of the Agate Beach closure fund or the general fund. That's to be determined by the council. But it would be paid back with meter revenues in a couple of years. So that's, so it's coming together, but it's a big project.
The graphic page.
Yeah.
Bottom part of it.
This part?
Yeah. I'm not sure. Well, specifically, lower left, where it says other dates there.
Yeah.
That totally out of context. I don't know what the other dates are, what you're talking about there. So that needs to be clarified in that box. And the whole bottom part, what people are going to be looking at is the pricing.
Yeah.
And where it applies. I don't know that it's necessary to say how many stalls are in each zone. I can't think of anybody that would really care. So that's just excess information. The important thing is e-permits available for zones A and B, you know, so they can get a order of magnitude as to how many permits are available, but how many spaces in each zone. I don't think that's necessary to be on there. I'm just giving my take because I do, you know, I love doing graphics and criticizing other people's.
Well, the parking advisory committee on that one was, they thought the information was helpful because it gives people a sense of how many permits are available relative to how many spaces exist. That's really what it does.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
It helped me from a context standpoint, seeing that info.
Says that you're selling more permits than there are spaces, in other words.
In zone C and D, yes. You're pretty much spot on zone A and B, which was intentional. I mean, for zone A and B, we didn't want to have. There's a bit of an art to this, but in the meter area, we wanted to make sure that all of our spaces aren't eaten up with permits. And so in the meter permit, we wanted to make sure that there were at least a reasonable number of spaces available to the casual person who's coming up, gets a space, pays a meter. You know pretty confidently that you're never going to be using 100, you're never going to have 100% of your permit folks down in that area at the same time. So it means that there will always be some percentage of those spaces that are available to the person who wants it. These are the most desirable spaces down there. That's why they're part of the meter permit program. If you move further away, then it's like, okay, we can sell more, say 140% or 120% of what our available spaces are. Because, you know, in which case you're going to have a larger percentage of what's available, you know, tied up with folks who have permits versus the casual user.
And are permits going to be allowed to be moved around? In other words, if Bornstein's buys 50 permits, can they put them in a box by the door and then whatever 50 employees happen to be working that day have a permit, some mechanism for swapping them around? Or is it tied to a person or a vehicle?
We're going to kind of that's where I said we're going to do one a little bit, do a little FAQ a little bit different for the commercial fishing. Because to your question about Bornstein's or the retailers and all that, no, it would be you obtain an e-permit. Now, you know, we're working out the final details with the Parking Advisory Committee about how many vehicle license plates can be attached to a particular e-permit. You know, because sometimes somebody goes down with their car versus their truck, you know, whatever. We'll get through that. For the commercial fishing, that's one where they'll be able to, for their area, which I think is what zone, it's in the zone. It's in this zone right here, which should be your zone, I believe it's zone B. They'll be able to obtain, it's an invite only for the commercial fishing. We're going to route it through the Port of Newport. So we'll get a list of all the commercial fishing operators via email. They'll get an email invitation to apply for that permit. And when they do that permit, they'll be able to buy a group of coupon, basically coupon codes for their deckhands and the like. Because one of the challenges they run into is they could be like about to go out, you know, I don't know, let's say halibut or whatever it is they're about to leave and depart on, and they're trying to get a deckhand at the last minute because somebody got sick or couldn't help them anymore. And so they're, you know, how do you accommodate that, make sure that works out? And so we'll set it up with a coupon code. They can buy a certain number of those to go for their boat. And so then if that deckhand shows up at the last minute, they can just punch in the code The commercial fishing will have a 72 hours is what they would have. One of the things we need to be very clear about is this only applies to public rights of way, or will only apply to public rights of way. This does not apply to Port of Newport properties or lots that the Port of Newport currently leases. Those are under their own port permit program, which the port commission wants to make sure they fully understand what we're going to do, because they're going to be coming in behind it, I believe, and adjusting theirs to kind of align well with it. So,
can you promise me that Ticketmaster isn't involved with this permitting?
So, that's a good one, Jim. So we have a new parking enforcement officer we just hired and is going through some initial training with our police department. And we are working with T2 on the license plate recognition, getting the equipment set up on the vehicle, all of that. That's all in process. It's going to take another 2 to 4 weeks probably before we get it all done. But we're still, it's all moving forward. And so that's where we're at.
I assume there's some kind of backup plan for when the equipment doesn't work. Like cell service goes out. Or you just blow it off and
acts of God.
For whatever period of time.
Yeah, I think that's a duration issue. I mean, if it's just a few minutes, that's one thing. Oh, you know, sure. If it's an extended period of time, I think you default to manual enforcement, which isn't going to pick up as many issues, but will, you know, they'll deal with the most egregious stuff. And again, this, I want to be emphasized, we put it in the FAQ, there's going to be a break-in period on this whole thing where once it's live, there'll be at least a 30-day window for, you know, forgiveness, where people, in, you know, because the change didn't know, we'll be waiving those.
Interesting to see how it works.
It's interesting because, you know, we have a number of key stakeholders on the bayfront that are part of that parking advisory committee that are, they're really plugged in, commercial fishing, business retailers, all of that. And it's taken a long time to get to a point where we're actually implementing. And, you know, some folks probably think it'll never happen. But, you know, what they try to emphasize, and I think this is fair, is we're trying to do it right and get it rolled out appropriately and fairly. And it takes time, and COVID didn't help. You know, we couldn't reasonably tackle something like that when we were tackling all the pandemic-related stuff, and the businesses were struggling to react to that reality. It wouldn't have been fair to throw another one on top of them. So, well, we are where we are.
Okay, next is web-based GIS map.
All right, Bob, what's wrong with it?
Nothing.
Ooh, all right.
Very impressed.
Wow.
And my problems with the city limits become increasingly obvious as you zoom in. And that was really my problem before with the city limits map, is you couldn't zoom in. It just turned to garbage, pixelated. Now, on this one, you can, and it... Well, the same area that Bill was just talking about, if you take a look at that, it's just silly, near as I can tell. City limits to come right up to the edge of the highway, drop down for several hundred yards, cross the highway, go back up, and continue right across from where you stopped.
Kind of like the Highway 20 piece? We probably have it up on the north side,
too. Oh, yeah, it's on the north side is where I was looking, but the Highway 21 is the same.
Yeah.
And I don't understand where that even ever came from. But now that it's here and we can actually see it, why don't we fix it?
That's a conversation with the state. I mean, it was a state highway right away. It wasn't annexed when they did those annexation packages back in the time.
I'm sorry, say again?
That's a conversation we'd have to have with ODOT. It's a state highway right away.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk to them about it.
Well, why does that affect our city limits? In fact, it's a state highway.
It's just that highway right away wasn't included in the annexation packages back when they did the annexations, that's all. I don't know that the state would object to annex it. The cost, there's a cost though that we'd have to incur to survey out that right away that would be brought in. I don't know that it impacts much though on Highway 20, for example, Bob, because it's a greenway area where there's no access anyway.
Oh, I'm more concerned with up by me. I'm the north end. And just the go up to the north end and zoom in on that. Go on. There you go.
Same principle, just smaller area. This one?
Yeah. And then there's that little jog up towards the north end of that. That must mean something. There's some property there that you would assume was in the city, but really isn't.
This is just a wider right-of-way up there. Is that what you're talking about, this little jog
yeah.
right here?
Yeah.
That's just a wider segment of the highway right-of-way. See? Not a lot. State picked up more right-of-way there for whatever reason. Who knows? There could be a culvert down there. I don't know.
We want it back.
But they picked up a wider... But, I mean, yeah, we can have the conversation with the state, but why is my question. I mean, what's it gain? Other than I know it bugs you to see the line
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, it bugs me a lot. And, you know, like Bill said, oh, well, you're going north and you hit city limits. Well, no, you hit city limits. If you're on the highway, you hit city limits at about what would be 74th. Mm-hmm. But if you're... walking the beach, you don't get to the city limits till all the way up by wherever that is.
Bullock Beach.
Yeah. I don't know if that makes a difference, but just...
Okay.
Just annoying. Write them a letter and just see if they would allow us to annex that. Well, then you have to go through the county, though, too, don't you? Or do you?
No. One thing I gotta check. I don't know if we're showing their UGB here. Is just where's our?
Is this the tempest in a teapot? I mean, how does it change our lives or the lives of our citizens?
It doesn't.
That was my point too. I was like, what do you gain by it? There's not a whole lot you really gain by it.
Accuracy.
It makes it a nice clean city boundary. I get that.
All right. Enough venting. Thank you for listening.
Did anybody have any other comments on this? I know we had talked about this a while ago, then we lost our GIS tech. It had to be shelved. We now have that position filled, and that individual spent some time to get this relaunched.
Okay, in the last 7 minutes that we have unfinished business.
This actually kind of jumps back into the parking discussion, so I'm going to bring it back up. That.
Parking and loading requirements is the big piece.
Okay, just one second here. Yeah, I popped down to this. This is a package of changes we discussed at a previous work session on May 22nd. Parking Advisory Committee had a chance to weigh in on it May 17th, and the City Council took a look at it too on the 20th of June. One of the things we had talked about in these special areas for parking, which would be the Bayfront, High Beach City Center, In those areas that get metered, there would be relief from all or a portion of the off-street parking requirements. The only area that's getting metered right now is the Bayfront. So I did tweak the language and make it clear that it only applies to the Bayfront. But the what I did was I took, based on your feedback and that from the other committees, I took options basically B2 and B3 and blended them, like we'd talked about. So uses within a special area where public parking meters are utilized, to make it very clear, in all or part of a special area may pay a fee in lieu of providing the off-street parking required in this section, provided the parking demand does not exceed 20 spaces. The top end limit was what was in B3 previously. And so such fee shall be an amount established by council resolution, and that would be a structured scaled one, kind of like we talked about. Uses with a parking demand in excess of 20 spaces must provide off-street parking sufficient to accommodate the excess demand. Parking ratios set out in our code are the ones that have to be used when doing that kind of analysis. The resolution setting the fee, I kind of set it up. John, you had made that comment. I think it was a fair one, that spaces 1 to 5 ought to be 0, since they're currently getting the benefit of up to 5 by paying the business license surcharge, which would be going away. So I kind of set it up that way. And I provided the examples. So it did cut the cost down quite a bit.
You should change the numbers on your spaces so you don't have overlap of, you have 10 in two columns, you have 15 in two columns. So maybe you should run it 5 to 9, 10 to 14, 15 to 20.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I mean,
Thank you. Just to stop confusion.
Sure. Because you know which one I'm going to select.
Yeah. No. Thank you. Yeah, that's helpful. Got it. So outside of that, I don't know that I really made much other, we didn't have a whole lot of other changes to make. I think I made the same clarification to C. Again, this will not apply, the comp plan policy that this is implementing talks about metering, and so I was just trying to tie it tight to the plan policy. So that was really not a lot of major changes here, but this is one where we want to get the process started so we can get this to a public hearing, hear what feedback is, so that it could be adopted potentially October, November, so it's close on the heels of when the metering goes into effect. And we can say, hey, look, we're following through with the whole package. This will make it a little bit easier for some of the properties down there to redevelop or expand. But it includes those caps, like that, no more than 20 spaces, so that we don't have a huge parking demand type use get down there and think that they can rely on just the existing available public spaces, that they'll have to provide some of their own spaces to. So if you're okay with this, and it's, look at this, 6:59, then I have this set up where you can do the motion to initiate the legislative process, and I can provide notice to the state 35 days prior to your first evidentiary hearing.
Okay.
How is this, if we approve this change, or the city council approves the change in September, say?
Yeah.
Who does it apply to? If somebody is already, like the hotel, if they've already submitted their plans, then it doesn't apply to them, right?
It wouldn't apply to them because they're relying upon an existing conditional use permit that says exactly how many parking spaces they're to provide.
Right. So this only applies for new development.
Prospective.
Right.
Now, understand, there's some language in here that says that if you were required by prior ordinance to provide a parking lot, so Local Ocean's a good example, then you're not going to be required to provide that
you can develop that lot.
Yeah, I saw that.
Okay.
That's all I had for the work session.
It's 7:01 and the work session has ended.